This episode, Once Upon a Time Lord, looking at the Doctor Who Technical Manual from 1983. And welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we are finding our joy by talking about that beloved wanderer in the fourth dimension, a madman with a box. Yes, we're talking about the television phenomena Doctor Who. Specifically, we'll be using the 1983 publication called The Doctor Who Technical Manual to frame our discussion about what it was like growing up as a Doctor Who fan. Now, my name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host, but I'm not doing this alone. My guest today dedicated his life to science and helping people by going on to become an actual real-life doctor. Though to be honest, I'm pretty sure he just did it because of his desperate devotion to Doctor Who and wanting to be called The Doctor. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Dr. Chris Lewis. How are you doing, Dr. Lewis? Thanks for being here.
I'm good. Thank you, Shag. And in the immortal words of Professor Riversong, hello, sweetie.
I am so excited to be talking about this. Of all my fandoms, and unfortunately there's quite a few, Doctor Who is probably the fandom I'm the most invested in, the one I've spent the most amount of time in my life. And so, folks, this is just going to be the first of many Doctor Who-themed episodes on this podcast. We're going to have a lot of them over the course of however long this podcast, years, 20 years, whatever. And now, not immediately, not like the next episode or anything, that'll be something else, but just somewhere down the line, we'll be doing more on Doctor Who. And I'm excited. Chris, you've been talking to me about us doing a Doctor Who episode for like, what, a year now, I think?
Badgering is the word you're looking for. Pestering. Yeah, I would say Doctor Who is my first love too. So I'm very excited, very honored to be here because I know there's lots of your regular contributors who are also Who fans. So it's real pleasure to be here and to talk to you today. It's great.
And I think, as we said, folks, we're going to be talking about the 1983 technical manual. I think Chris and I have sort of stumbled on a cheat sheet, if you will, on how to talk about Doctor Who because we're not actually going to spend that much time talking about the technical manual. Instead, we're using it as a framework or a springboard just to talk about what it was like growing up as a Doctor Who fan. So it's a little bit of a cheat, but I think it's going to make for a quick, fun, rapid-fire discussion, I think.
Great.
So I do want to mention, folks, for those of you who are coming back to the show from the V podcast and things like this, this is going to be a little bit more of what the format of the show is going to be going forward. You know, single guest, single topic, hopefully shorter in length. Hopefully Chris and I won't go 3 hours. All three of the V episodes, those are very special circumstances. I adore those discussions. And I'm very proud of that work. But that was a very long form project. You know, that was 3 hours long. It was crazy. But most of the episodes that we're going to be doing going forward will be more like the very first episode or this one, you know, a lot shorter in length.
Just know, Shag, that we could talk for 3 hours and we're sparing the listeners from that.
Oh, it's absolutely true. I mean, I'm going to steal a little bit from Chris's notes here. But like, you know, all the topics we're going to talk about, there's, I don't know, probably 10 topics we're going to talk about. Each one of those could be a 3 hour episode into itself. I mean, there's so much to unpack on Doctor Who. And we're just a real quick rapid fire.
This is a taster for the rest of Doctor Who to come and lots of other contributors, I hope, as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So, and also stick around. Once Chris and I finish our discussion, I am going to tackle your feedback from the previous episodes of Once Upon a Geek from your comments that were on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com. All right. Before we get into the Doctor Who discussion, though, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors, folks. This episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a comic book collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library, and usually it will be tied to the discussion in some way, shape, or form. I picked Doctor Who 8th Doctor Hardcover Volume 1, Matter of Life and Death. And what this is from Titan Comics. They did a miniseries all about the 8th Doctor, the Paul McGann Doctor. It took place during sort of the War Doctor era, where he's wearing the outfit he was in Night of the Doctor. Anyway, it's a great little miniseries. He meets his new companion named Josie. The writer is George Mann. The artist is Emma Viaselli. The cover artist is Alice Zhang. And let me tell you, there's not a lot of opportunities to find 8th Doctor comic books. There weren't outside of the Doctor Who magazine strips. And this miniseries, there really isn't much out there for you to ever find. So this is a great chance to spend time with the Eighth Doctor, Paul McGann, because he is such an amazing doctor, and they really did a great job capturing the spirit of him in this miniseries. It's 128 pages, it's full color, it's a hardcover, normally goes for $19.99, but you can get it for 25% off right now, so it's only $14.99, and I highly recommend it. Again, Eighth Doctor, hardcover, volume 1, Matter of Life and Death, super fun. Now, Chris, did you happen to bring it in Stock Trades pick?
I did, and I'm going to start with a confession, because the comics for Doctor Who are a bit of a blind spot for me. I know the strips from the Doctor Who mag, like the old ones, the Iron Legion and Star Beast, they were drawn by an artist, an up-and-coming artist. You might not have heard of him, Shag, and you might want to make a note of the name. Dave Gibbons. Yeah, that Dave Gibbons.
Never heard of him.
But those collections aren't available on in-stock trades. So I've gone into what you might call a relative dimension of sci-fi comics for my recommendation. See what I did there? This is Dan Dare Complete Collection Hardcover Volume 1, The Venus Campaign. And Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future, was first published in the classic British comic The Eagle in 1950. And these are the original adventures of one of the best-known British comic characters, presented in gorgeous new library editions, also from Titan Comics. This omnibus contains Dan's first three full adventures, digitally remastered for the first time. Is this a character you've read before, Shag? Do you know much about Dan Dare?
I really don't. I know of his existence, and I know of his popularity with the British fan base, but I've never been exposed to him.
So in this set of stories, Dan and his crew set off to explore Venus, hoping to find new resources to feed a starving Earth. But the planet is already the lair of the pint-sized megalomaniac, the Mekon. And if you don't know the Mekon, think a cross between Davros and the Silver Surfer. Okay?
Oh, gosh.
Plans to conquer the Earth. Now, it's up to Dare and his sidekick, Digby, to help the enslaved people of Venus to rise up and defeat the massive green-headed evil genius. If you like Doctor Who, if you like the Britishness of Doctor Who, I think you're going to like this. So this is Titan Books. It's written and the beautiful, exquisite painted art by Frank Hampson. It's hardcover. It was $59.99 in stock trades price, $44.99. You save 25% and then you're really close to that free kablam shipping.
Nice callback with kablam. Took me a minute there. So that's fantastic. All right, folks, check out these two products over on In Stock Trades. And for all your comic book trade paperbacks, please visit instocktrades.com. We appreciate their support. Now, folks, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows, you know, really requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the shows on this network, the best way to support us is by visiting patreon.com/FW podcast. And please consider supporting the Firewater Podcast Network. In a certain tiers, you get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to David Ace Gutierrez.
So he's the explosive, obsessed sidekick to your Seventh Doctor, Shag, I think.
I think that's where Ace comes from, actually, yes. And also thanks go out to Gord Tolton,
who definitely sounds like a 60s Doctor Who character, probably a Cyberman collaborator or something.
I think you're right. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. All right. Now, remember, everybody, the show is here to represent our entire geeky community and the things that we celebrate. So we want to hear from you. We need you to share your thoughts and opinions on Doctor Who, how you became a fan, you know, who's your favorite doctor, all the usual stuff. And the best way to be part of the conversation is in our comment section of our website. So just visit firewaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Leave your thoughts on the show post for this episode. If you're out on the social medias, you can also find us on Twitter as Once Upon a Geek, or you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Now, again, with the way the feedback works, if you share your thoughts on our website, I will be reading portions of that on every fifth episode of Once Upon a Geek. Now, this happens to be the fifth episode, so even though time can be wibbly-wobbly, I won't have your comments from this episode by the time you're listening to it. So I will be reading feedback from the previous episodes. So therefore, the feedback on this one will appear in the 10th episode. So go out to our website and leave your thoughts there. All right, so Dr. Lewis, here we go. We have got the Doctor Who Technical Manual from September 1983. I've got my physical copy right here.
And me, my hot little hand.
And what we're going to do, folks, is we are going to use essentially the table of contents, and we'll flip through it as we go too, but we're going to use the table of contents as our guide for a discussion about how it was like Chris and I growing up as Doctor Who fans. We're cheating. We're really using this as a framework. Now, the book itself, this was one in a series of titles that were released during the 20th anniversary of the show. So 1983, started in 1963. This was all part of the producer, a guy named John Nathan Turner. It was part of his desire to capitalize on the program's success and merchandising opportunities. We're going to go through this, as I said, very rapid fire. So each one of these things, we could talk for hours about each one. So you're going to hear us skip over things if you're a Doctor Who fan, probably have in your head. That's okay. Put it in the comment section. And again, I promise you, we'll probably get to all these topics some point on the show. So the very first one, you know, right on page 7 is the introduction. It's a brief little introduction by John Nathan Turner. And by brief, I mean, like, it only takes up a quarter of the page. It's very strange.
He was a busy man. He had better things to do with his time.
Exactly. They could have just used a bigger font, right? Anyway. Yeah. So I'm going to, you know, sort of wibbly wobbly this by saying the introduction is going to be about me and Chris. So Chris, what was your introduction? How did you find the show?
Well, Shag, it seems reasonable for this podcast to be the place where I officially come out as British. I'm of a certain age. And so in the 70s, when I was growing up, we had three TV channels, and Doctor Who was on the main one, BBC One, at Saturday tea time. So it wasn't exactly hidden away. You know, it was not hard to find. And it was, you know, the kind of program that interests all my friends of the same age. So, yeah, it was just there. And I didn't really have to search out for it. But what about you? Was it a kind of 2 a.m. on PBS thing?
You're not far off. So I've been a fan now. I did the math just last night. I've been a fan for almost 40 years now, which is just terrifying to me. I was 10 years old, which is like the golden age to find Doctor Who, right?
Yes.
So it was on a local PBS station, and it wasn't quite 2 in the morning. It was more like 10 o'clock at night. And I was desperate for something to watch at age 10. And I'm upstairs in this big quiet house with a TV in a room all by myself. And I'm just switching channels, and I find this glimpse of a scene from Genesis of the Daleks, which is like a 1970s episode featuring Tom Baker. That's the guy with the scarf, and the Daleks are the big bad guys. And at that point, the PBS, well, I guess they still are, they're affiliated with our local college. So I thought, as I'm watching this, you know, come on, it's a little creaky looking. I mean, you got to admit, the special effects weren't there. The production value was kind of low. So I thought I was watching some cheap college knockoff of Star Wars. I kid you not. I thought the Doctor was supposed to be like a Luke Skywalker analog. Harry Sullivan was supposed to be a Han Solo analog. Sarah Jane Smith was a Princess Leia analog. And they're looking through a window at Davros and the Daleks, who clearly must have been Darth Vader and the Stormtroopers. So I watched, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes of it and just dismissed it immediately. Done with this. This is clearly not for me. A few weeks later, maybe it's a couple of months, I'm not really sure. Either way, it's late one Saturday night and I'm by myself again up in this room, in this big house with this quiet little room. And again, it's probably 10 o'clock at night. And I stumbled across the 90-minute compilation movie for The Hand of Fear. This is another one with Tom Baker, guys, the one with the scarf. Anyway, this is essentially a horror story about a severed hand threatening everyone. And then the next Saturday, I happen to catch the next 90-minute compilation movie, which is called The Deadly Assassin, another horror-inspired one. So basically, the 10-year-old me was terrified. And when you're 10 years old, terrified is actually pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So I was also hooked.
So you stumbled on Genesis of the Daleks, Hand of Fear, and what was the other one?
The Deadly Assassin.
You got three fantastic stories. Boy, did you fall on your feet.
I really did. I got extremely lucky, and I've been hooked ever since, man. All right, so we got to ask, now, since we're talking about the technical manual, what is your own personal history with the technical manual? I'll go first this time. I got mine in probably 1984 or 1985, somewhere in that range. I didn't get it in 83. But in 1985, I did get a chance to go to a Doctor Who convention, and which weren't all that common here in the States. It was it came to our town, and it was John Nathan Turner and Peter Davison who came here. In fact, my copy I'm looking at right now still has John Nathan Turner's signature right in the front.
You are such a name dropper.
I am. JNT, we were tight. And of course, it's the 80s, and I was a kid, so my mother has stamped my home address in the inside cover of the book. I guess... assuming it's lost. I mean, you know, she didn't write my name in my underwear, but it feels like that's about as close, right? So anyway, for me, this history with this book is I read this thing cover to cover over and over and over and over. This was my Wikipedia, basically, for Doctor Who in the 1980s. I read this thing over and over, and I would draw the characters in there, like the Daleks especially. I would draw the quote-unquote technical sketches of the Dalek over, and I wasn't a good artist, but I would draw. I had onion skin paper, and I would trace them. I was obsessed with drawing the Daleks. What about you? What's your history with the book?
Yeah, I suppose you should describe it, really. It's quite a slim volume. It's sort of, I'm sure there's a technical, it's about sort of A4 size, but it's only 62 pages. So it's quite a skinny little book. And it's got this really, let's be generous, eclectic selection of entries. Some
That's
of
fair.
Which are really blindingly obvious, like the TARDIS and Daleks and the Sonic Screwdriver. And some are really weird and almost unidentifiable. If anybody has this book and listening, I would like to know which story the space freighter came from. Anybody knows, leave it in the comments, but some of them are bizarre.
I'm guessing Frontier in Space. That's the best thing I can guess, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. I was thinking Space Pirates, but okay. If you know, please tell me. I remember the 20th anniversary as being quite a big deal. I did get this in 1983 because over here, obviously, there was a lot of stuff for the 20th anniversary. And there was even they had a cover of the Radio Times, which is our TV guide equivalent, was painted, you know, when it was the Five Doctors, you know, the episode on the TV, which was meant to represent the anniversary. And this manual, it's a bit odd because it does look like it could have stood for a little bit more editing and a little bit more time on it, because the entries, some of them are incredibly detailed and technical, like there's proper technical drawings of the TARDIS and cross sections through Daleks. And some of them look like they've been thrown together, just photostated photographs. And the Sonic Screwdriver is really weird because to be a technical manual, they've put a scale on it. But the scale for the Sonic Screwdriver is wrong. The Sonic Screwdriver looks about 6.5 feet long. It's a Godzilla's Sonic Screwdriver. So somebody needed to spend a little bit more time on what was, you know, a piece of merchandise for a really big anniversary. So it's a little bit weird. But like you, it was just something I pored over because to have these technical details was so fascinating and so interesting. And it just got read and read and reread over and over again.
And for me, you know, at least over here in the States, we didn't have access to very much Doctor Who stuff. Mm. I mean, very, very little. So this was, you know, kind of a holy grail for a long time to say, oh, I've got something that goes beyond just a novelization or whatever. So, So all right, the next question. So the next chapter, I should say, after the introduction is who is the Doctor? So without going into a lot of detail there, because it talks all about his history. And folks, I'm assuming if you're listening, you have an idea who the Doctor is by this point. But we're going to use that question to sort of spin it and say, what did we love about the show as a kid? And what do we love about it now? So why don't you go first this time?
So I want to give this quote from Terence Dicks. Terence Dicks was one of the script editors back in the 70s. And for the show notes, for new writers, he gave a thumbnail sketch to the Doctor. And this is what it says. And I'm just going to apologize for the pronouns, because now we know that female is also a regenerative option for the Doctor. But in those days, it was all male. So apologies for the pronouns. Terence Dicks says, he is impulsive, idealistic, ready to risk his life for a worthy cause. He hates tyranny and oppression and anything that is anti-life. He never gives in and he never gives up, however overwhelming the odds against him. The Doctor believes in good and fights evil. Though often caught up in violent situations, he's a man of peace. He is never cruel or cowardly. And I suppose, you know, Rob talks about Hawkeye as a fictional character that means a lot to him and the sort of values came off the screen. And I would say that for me, for the Doctor, you know, that you know, somebody who's not afraid to stand up for things that are unfair, that they can be persistent without being violent, that they can be brave, that they can be peaceful, they can be kind, they can be insightful. I would like those things for myself. And I suppose, you know, I took a lot of that on and I hope sort of incorporate it as best I can. The Doctor's not perfect and neither am I, but, you know, those are the kind of things. So I suppose from that perspective, that's what it meant. But I suppose there's also the other thing that the show is just a wild romp. It's hugely enjoyable. It's silly, but it's clever and it's scary. And when it's done well, that the show turns those qualities on a sixpence. It can go from one thing to another very, very fast. The morals are wholesome. You know, the Doctor's respectful of everybody. He puts kindness and cleverness winning out over force and greed and self-interest. And as with your first show, Shag, it's pure nostalgia. You know, watching the old shows takes me back to a safe, comfortable place. It was usually on in the autumn, in the fall over here. So it might well be dark and windy and stormy outside, but it's a safe place. It's a nostalgic place with my family. We're sitting, we're eating our tea, we're on the sofa together. It's a good feeling.
A lot of my answers have to echo yours, so I'll keep it short. You know, for me, I was fascinated by time travel. Always have been, still am. And you touched on this, so the diversity of the show as well. You know, one episode is horror, the next episode is sci-fi, then historical. Nowadays, you know, you get an episode that's comedy as well. The show could be anything. I love that diversity. And a lot of very similar feelings about the Doctor. I mean, the Doctor is absolute. The Doctor will always do the right thing, no matter what, will always stand up for the little guy who needs help. And for the last 25 years, no exaggeration, I have been wearing the same necklace every day. And it's just a leather cord with a key to the TARDIS on it.
just in case it shows up.
No, but I bought it shortly after the TV movie. And back then, at the time, the WWJD bracelets were very, very popular here in the States. It was What Would Jesus Do? So I consider that my What Would the Doctor Do necklace. And so I tried to wear that in to remind me to do the right thing when I didn't always want to, hopefully remind me to do the right thing. Does it always work? Probably not. But it's something, an ideal to strive for. And, you know, for decades over here in the States, Doctor Who also felt very, very niche. You know, I felt like I could be, you know, back in, you know, 1983 or whatever, I felt like I could be an expert, you know, because over here, Star Wars and Star Trek, you know, it's everywhere. It's omnipresent and it belongs to everyone, right? There was always going to be someone who was more into Star Wars or Star Trek than me, but there weren't many Doctor Who fans. So I could feel like a big fish in a small pond. And I still love the show for all those same reasons. I mean, it's not niche anymore by any means, but, you know, a lot of the nostalgia you mentioned, but there's also a genuine love for the material. And, you know, one of the things I think too that helped foster my deep, deep passion was when the show went off the air in 1989, folks, it was gone for 16 years. It wasn't on the air at all. 1989 and 2005, we call that the wilderness years, by the way. But I was reading and listening to everything Doctor Who produced. I was online on message boards. I was so steeped in Doctor Who at that point. I felt like I was completely involved in every aspect of Doctor Who, because back then you could affordably collect everything and you could keep up all the content. Nowadays, it's absolutely impossible. But that was sort of my golden age. Sadly, when the show was off the air was the time when I was most heavily invested in it. All right. So the next chapter is all about the TARDIS, right? You get a section about the TARDIS. You get a section about the TARDIS police box. You get the TARDIS toolkit and the sonic screwdriver. So you get all the various, you know, paraphernalia that the Doctor needs on his adventures, right? You even get cross sections of the console and things like that. Now, you know, the toolkit's kind of weird. Most of that, you know, it's basically a toolbox, right? Most of the inside pieces, which they have drawings of all this, most of it never appeared on screen. And staring at it, I'm pretty sure this big giant one called the magnetic clamp, I think in the 1996 TV movie, I'm pretty sure that's what Grace smashed him across the skull and knocked him out with.
Yeah, a little Easter egg there. So I seem to recall it first showing up in a story called Earthshock, where they have to defuse a bomb. But I don't think we went into the detail of absolutely everything that was in it. So when this came out, you know, fantastic. You know, we could see inside the toolbox, and somebody, bless them, because obviously they have, has listed everything in the internet that they think is in there, which goes, as far as I can see, not just through what's in the technical manual, but also what's referenced in other stories, including the big Finish audios and all sorts of things. So yeah, so that's out there too.
It was just fascinating, the idea of the Doctor Who had a toolkit, right? They, you know, for those of us back then, it's like, oh wow, you know. And I imagine they had probably intended to use it more, you know, to give the Doctor a toolbox. Was kind of a cool idea, but clearly didn't use that much. But I'm glad they brought it back from the 96 TV movie.
The sonic screwdriver has to come from somewhere. It's not sitting alongside a photon chisel, then, you know, where's it?
So in the classic era of 1980s, right, as a fan, you know, probably the most important item in any Doctor Who fan's toolkit at that point in the 1980s was their Target novelizations. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Really important, because TV was ephemeral.
Yep.
You know, this was a time before VCRs. We certainly didn't have a VCR. So, and as far as I knew, these episodes had gone out and nobody had stored them ever. So when we got a Target book called The Making of Doctor Who, which listed all the stories, my goodness, did that open your eyes to what had already gone before. And so the novelizations were the only way you were ever, ever, ever going to experience some of the Hartnell and Troughton and Pertwee stories, because they were never coming back, except I now have them all on DVD in my library. So, so important.
We were told at the time that most of the stuff from the 60s was just lost forever, that they had not been recorded, they'd been erased, or they'd been recorded and erased, and so we were never going to get access to it. So yeah, the Target novelizations was the only way to experience them. And just so you guys know, these little novelizations, they're very, very slim, and they're basically just recaps of like the teleplay. You know, we're talking 120 to 160 pages, and written for that, the audience, the target market, was like these 10 to 14 year old kids, is really what it was.
And again, Terence Dix wrote a lot of those, and he is credited with being the cause of an awful lot of literacy for boys, particularly in this country, in that, you know, in that age group that would have written them, because that they would not read anything else. And so, you know, just like comics can be tools for education, target novelizations, immensely powerful tools. And for us, I mean, my brother and I were quite good readers anyway, but we would spend our holidays with my grandparents, and they lived, 200 yards away from their local library. And we would literally be camping out on the steps of the library, you know, quarter of an hour before they opened, to rush in, exchange our target books that we'd read the day before to get two new ones. We would both run back, read both books, and be back the following morning. So, you know, we just devoured them.
For me, somewhat similarly, as far as the devouring, I just couldn't get enough of them. I used to be in the band. I played the trumpet for a while, and we had band practice after school once a week, and I believe it was Wednesdays. Either way, I looked forward to that day so much, because after band practice, I would walk across the street to the local mall and wait for my mom to get off work, and I hung out there, and there was a bookstore called DuBay's Bookstore, and every week, at least I think it was every week, I was buying a new Doctor Who book. And I was so excited, and I only had enough money usually for one book, maybe two. And so I would just stare at, you know, what felt like hundreds of these things, right? I'm like, oh, what should I buy? Oh my gosh, should I buy Power of Crawl? Should I get, you know, Robot? Should I get, you know, I don't know, Earthshock, you know, whatever. And it was so exciting. It was like a kid in a candy store. And, you know, it was very clever the way they did these things. They would produce books about the earlier doctors without putting their likenesses on the cover. And, you know, they might instead put the monster or the TARDIS or whatever, because, you know, here I am, this 10, 11 year old kid, whatever. And without the actor on the cover, I was more willing to pick up those books based on the old 1960s episodes, you know.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, sometimes if I saw a picture of William Hartnell, I'd be like, well, I'll buy this Tom Baker one instead. You know, one of the later doctors, one of the ones I was more familiar with. So by not having the doctor on the cover, it worked, because the very first one I ever bought was Keys Emeritus, which is a first doctor adventure from like,
I don't know, early one. Yeah,
like 1964 or something like that. Very, very early. And it is packed full of crazy sci-fi concepts. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Now, I finally saw the episode itself, like, I don't know, 15, 20 years later, and the book was better. So, you know, it was great. And again, because they simply put a great image of the TARDIS on the cover, that's why I bought it as a kid.
It's great for a show that's made in 1964, but the visuals in your head are so much better.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head there. I credit the Target novelizations with giving me my passion for reading. You know, I could certainly read before these books. That wasn't the issue. I just wasn't passionate about it. So, you know, I would devour these things, couldn't get enough of them. I still have all of mine, by the way, a nearly complete collection of them. And I, you know, similar to what you're describing, I had the opportunity to tell Terence Dix once about how he helped play a massive role in giving me my love for reading. So I was happy to do that.
Yeah, it's terrific. And they are coming back. You know, some of the newer stories are getting novelized now. And there's been, Terence Dix sadly passed away not that long ago, but there are some really beautiful hardback compendiums of his Target novels, which are sitting on my bookcase in pride of place.
Now, they also publish things like the episode guides and things like that, because once I got my hands on the episode guides, those also became a absolutely necessary resource to look up all this old stuff about the show that, you know, the episodes I would never see or even hear of. Very, very valuable resource. All right, so let's keep going through the technical manual here. So, all right, we've looked at all the tools, and now we get to the TARDIS console, right? So we get this awesome drawing of all six sides of the console, because, you know, as a kid, you were desperate to know what every switch did, what everything on the TARDIS did. And this gives you lots of names. Doesn't just, like, tell you what everything does, but it gives you lots of names there for stuff. So since we're talking about the TARDIS console, what, of all the years, what is your favorite console room?
Oh, this is which is your favorite child, isn't it? so many pieces. I mean, the one I'm most familiar with is the sort of fourth, fifth Doctor White one, which is a classic for a reason. But then there's the Pertwee one where the roundels look like washing up bowls. That's really weird, but really kind of cool as well. And then the wood paneled one, which is, again, sort of slightly Jules Verne-y. I like the scale when they do it really big in the new series. So I think if I have to pick one, it's going to be the TV movie because it was so revolutionary. It was moved so far away from the TV set and it kept a few of the traditional things, but it really kind of updated it and made it such a cool space to be in. So yeah, I'm going to go TV movie, but boy, it's a hard choice.
It is absolutely a tough choice. Well, I should say this, my second favorite's a tough choice because the first one is not hard at all. It's absolutely the Eighth Doctor TV movie. Paul McGann went from 1996. You described it. I mean, yeah, that one is the most Jules Verne of them all. You've got wood paneling. You've got brass everywhere. You've got giant, you know, metal, steel, I don't even know what you call them, buttresses around it. The roof opens up to space. You've got a comfy chair. He's got bookcases, dramatic lighting, candles, clocks. I mean, it's so gothic. It is so gothic and so gorgeous. And I can't tell you how many hours I've lost just staring at photos online of that whole console room. It's just beautiful. And in fact, I bought the Eagle Moss. They make little sculptures. Eagle Moss makes these little sculptures of the TARDIS consoles. And that's the only one I've purchased, was the Eighth Doctor one. It's just so pretty.
Good choice.
Now, I will tell you, if I had to pick a second favorite, it would probably be Matt Smith's first TARDIS, because sort of similar to the Paul McGann one, it's lots of metal, lots of, you know, very Jules Verne-y. Now, that one's got a lot of glass. It's a little more 50s, 1950s, really. Mm-hmm. But there's some similarities, it feels like to me, between the Matt Smith one and the Paul McGann one. Mm-hmm. All right. So next section is, there's a whole section about the Daleks in here. So there's a whole section on Davros and the Daleks. You get two pages of description. It talks about the conflicting origins, because we've had different origins for the Daleks over the years.
Because in 60 years, nobody was keeping continuity. It's like DC Comics. You've got to retrofit stuff in there.
Exactly. You've got some fun drawings of Davros. Then you've got a cutaway of a Dalek. You actually see all the little pieces, parts inside the Dalek. That's got to be, I think, probably the most interesting drawing in the book, where you've got all the cutaway in there. And then it goes on to do sort of almost architectural drawings of several different Daleks. You get the ones from the Hartnell era. You get the ones from the Peter Cushing movie, which is crazy.
Yes, that's great.
Which confused the heck out of me, because I didn't know about that as a kid.
They are re-releasing the Peter Cushing movies very soon. And in fact, this weekend, we're going to the cinema to see the double bill.
Well, by the time you hear this, folks, this will have been in the past, so you can't go with Chris. I'm sorry, terribly sorry.
Wibbly wobbly, timey wimey.
Exactly. And you always know it's the Peter Cushing Dalek, because instead of a sucker, they've got these giant claws. And then they go on to the more traditional one that we knew in the 80s. And then they even get a picture of the Emperor Dalek, which was just fascinating to me as a kid. So this leads us to our question, what is your favorite Dalek story? Not necessarily the best, but the favorite. I'll go first this time, since I let you go first the last couple times. So I strongly, strongly consider Genesis of the Daleks, which is the Tom Baker episode. You know, he's the guy with the scarf. This was the retelling of the Dalek origin. That was an absolutely fantastic one. It's, you know, commonly regarded as one of the best Doctor episodes of all time. I strongly consider that one. I strongly consider Day of the Daleks, which is a John Pertwee episode, which features all kinds of time travel paradoxes. I even considered Resurrection of the Daleks, which is Peter Davison. He's the guy that wore the cricket outfit. And that was an episode that was one of my earliest, because Peter Davison was the current Doctor when I started watching. Mm. So I have a lot of love for that. But I settled upon Remembrance of the Daleks. So this is from 1988, 25th anniversary Doctor Who. It stars Sylvester McCoy. He's the little guy with the umbrella and has the question mark on his sweater. And the story is about two warring factions of Daleks, and they're in a civil war. And what's one set of them's white, one set of them's black. I mean, there are a lot of issues they hit in the story straight on about racism. They don't try and shy away from it. Well, I guess you say some of them are subtle, some are not. But they really tackle a lot of racism issues in the story. It also adds a lot of mystery to the Doctor. They layer in all the stuff about his past that we never knew. They start to put some mystery back in.
Talking about conflicting origins.
Right,
okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very action-oriented. They bring back the military. It feels a lot like a UNIT episode.
Yeah.
And the Target book actually added more to the story because it was written by the guy who wrote the episode. And that was something that novelizations never did back then. So that's my pick, Remembrance of the Daleks. What about you? What is your favorite Dalek story?
Nobody is going to argue with a special weapons Dalek, at least not for long. So, yeah, honorable mentions, Genesis of the Daleks, because it is a stone cold classic apart from the giant clam. And Davros is just one of the best villains in the history of the show. Bit of diminishing returns when he keeps coming back. But yeah, that Genesis one is just spectacular. But I think you're right. It's a little bit like Watchmen to me. You wouldn't give Watchmen to somebody who's completely new to comics, even though it's brilliant. You've got to have a little bit of context first. So Genesis, really good, but perhaps not for a first time view. Day of the Daleks, I love. And it's the same reason as because of the Target novelization. I read this, must have been around the same time as the Technical Annual. So, you know, early 80s. I didn't see it on DVD until 2011, but that story was living in my head for that time. And it is, like you say, it's probably the first time travel paradox story I ever read. You know, it vividly is in my head from the book rather than from the TV. And I have to say, the TV version, the budget does show on occasion. So my favorite, and again, for pure nostalgic reasons, is Destiny of the Daleks.
Oh, wow.
And it's not a great story. It's a bit silly because Douglas Adams was the script editor at this point, and so he does add in quite a lot of Douglas Adams type humor, if you're familiar with that from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's got this really silly regeneration of his companion Romana, who was a Time Lady. It's got Mavellans, who are the enemies of the Daleks, and also of the Doctor. It's complicated, but they do look like they've just stepped out of a disco, and it is a total and utter continuity nightmare. But none of that matters, because I was 8 and it was the start of a new series of my favorite program, and it was the freaking Daleks. And I spent the whole day playing Doctor Who, making Doctor Who models. It was a glorious sunny weekend. It was the last day before we went back to school, and it is a total nostalgia fest for me. So that just has all the feels.
You know, I actually considered that one because of the, not because of the story, but because of the trappings. You know, Romana, the introduction of Lala Ward as Romana, her costume in that one, the pink jacket with the white scarf. Yeah, she should have kept that through the whole series. She looked fantastic in it. That's a fun one. Good choice.
Yeah.
All right. So the next section is all about K-9. K-9!
Yay!
Our beloved robotic dog, the Doctor's companion through much of the Tom Baker era. I should mention, by the way, there's like 6 pages, I think it is, of color insets, photos from the show in the middle of it. Because, you know, one thing we didn't say, the manual is just white paper with blue ink. That's all it is, right? Yeah. They're the only color are these 6 pictures in the middle. So
the most zipper tone you'll see ever in your life. In
Boy, that's the truth. That is the truth. So, all right, we get a section on K-9. Again, a great companion. So that leads us to our question, which is, who is your favorite companion? Not necessarily the best, because there's a lot of arguments you can make, but who is your favorite? So I'll let you go first on this one.
I think it's really tough, because when I started watching, and when I remember watching, it was kind of Sarah and Harry. And then we had such a good run of companions. Leela, the two Romanas, K-9, Adric, maybe Adric, Snissa, Tegan, Turlough, Perry. What a great run of characters. And they have a tough job in the classic series, because they have to be the audience perspective. So they have to go, but why, Doctor? What is it, Doctor? Doctor, what is it? How is this happening? They have to be the questioner, the one that doesn't really understand, but at the same time, independent enough to think that they can cope and vulnerable enough to need the Doctor. So they've got to be quite reassuring, but also at peril. And so that's a really tough job. And I think the actors that they got for these actually fairly thankless roles were brilliant. And unlike the new series, there's not a lot of room for personal growth. You can suddenly, when you need to leave the show, you suddenly go off and get married, or, you know, have an unheard of fascination of Eastern mysticism, or you were a political exile that we never knew about. We've been with you for 2 years and we didn't know any of this about you until your last story, because it's a way of getting you out of the show. But I think amongst the tough field, if I have to pick a favourite, it's Sarah Jane Smith. I think Liz Sladen, what a terrific actor, just nailed the right tone, played well against Tom Baker, who was mercurial, to say the least, and struck enough of a chord with audiences that they brought her back in the new era. So, yeah, Sarah Jane, I think, for me.
It's interesting. My favourite companion is not hard. It is absolutely Sarah Jane Smith. You're right, dead on. Mm. The second favorite would be The Real Challenge. I think actually with my, because I've done this before, and like once you get past the obvious of Sarah Jane, it does get a lot more complicated. Now for me, you know, I came to Doctor Who, all those episodes I mentioned, those were Sarah Jane episodes. You know, she was my first companion. I watched her as a 10-year-old boy. You know, she was brave. She was a true friend. She was a hero. And all the same things that you, all the reasons you just described. But for me also, you know, I watched her when I was 10. 25 years later, I sat down with my own children and watched the same actress play the same character again in new adventures. And she was still brave. She was still a true friend and she was a hero. You know, it was absolutely wonderful. Like, I can't think of any other franchise where people are able to do that. You know, maybe Star Wars, you know, but even then, you know, it was about the next generation of characters. She got her own spinoff, you know. She got two spinoffs, technically.
Two.
Yeah, really. And as far as actors and actresses go, like, I don't get emotional about an actor or an actress when they pass away. It's nothing personal. I don't know these people. You know, they're famous. I watch their movies. It's sad that they're gone, but they're not like they're part of my family. So I don't tend to get emotional. I can only think of one or two exceptions, and one of them was Liz Sladen. Her passing just it knocked me in for a loop. I still get emotional when I think about her. When I watch an episode and Liz Sladen cries on screen, I cry on screen. I'm getting teary-eyed right now, darn it. All right, so I'm going to move on. So I'm going to cheat a little. I do have some honorable mentions, people that I, when you come to second place, it becomes very hard for me. So I'm going to name some from the classic series and then the new series, and then we'll move on. But honorable mentions would be Romana too, Lala Ward. She's amazing. Mm-hmm. And the actress is super, super nice. Got to meet her recently. Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, Nicholas Courtney was amazing. Tegan Javanka, you know, Janet Fielding, companion to the Fifth Doctor. And then Ace, Sophie Aldred. You know, all those were fantastic companions. I think I like the companions that stand up to the Doctor, I think is what that tells you from that list right there, the ones that tell the Doctor off. And this continues with the new series, because in the new series, my favorites are Amy Pond, played by Karen Gillan, and Donna Noble, played by Catherine Tate, both also tell the Doctor, you know, what for quite often. And then I just absolutely adore Graham, played by Bradley Walsh. She's just something I'm so enjoyable. Yeah, so enjoyable about
him. So good, yeah.
All right, so we keep trip hammering through this again, folks. Every single one of these topics could be a whole episode. In fact, I want to say, Chris, if I remember right, this episode started life as a discussion about Target Books. Wasn't that what this was going to be originally?
we had a number of things we could have talked about, like Doctor Who and the Pescatons.
Oh, goodness.
The History of Time and Space, which is such an interesting relic of the wilderness years. And I think definitely we should come back to that at some point. But yeah, we've talked about all sorts of things, and there is such a lot to explore.
Yeah. So right now we are going to talk about the Cybermen. There's a section on the Cybermen. You get a 2-page description about their life on Mondas and Telos, things like that. You get 3 different technical sketches of various Cybermen, the Mark I from 10th Planet, the Mark II from Moonbase and Tomb of the Cybermen. You get Mark 5 from the Invasion, and you get the Cybermats. You get 2 different types of Cybermats. So a lot on the Cybermen. Our question is going to be here, what's your favorite version of the Cybermen, or your favorite Cyberman story? And for me, my favorite version of the Cybermen is the classic ones. I love the Patrick Troughton versions of the Cybermen, specifically the early version before the Invasion. And I'm more of a Cyberman fan than I am a Dalek fan, which I know for some people that's aghast and horrible. But Cybermen are my preferred villains. I think they're just the idea of a human being getting locked inside that shell and losing their emotions is just so terrifying to me.
Yeah, it's definitely a body horror thing that I don't think they can do given the budget and given the audience for this. But yeah, the most recent ones, the Haunting of Villa Diodati is probably the closest they can get. But you could go quite dark with the Cybermen, couldn't you?
Yeah. And so for me, again, what is my favorite? Not necessarily the best. My favorite Cyberman story is Moonbase. It's one of Patrick Troughton's first season. So this is the Second Doctor. We're talking black and white, early 60s. And now, to be fair, you know, Tomb of Cybermen or Invasion is probably better. I don't care. Moonbase is my favorite. I adore it. I read the Target book long before I ever saw the episode. That cover is gorgeous of the Cybermen floating in space. You know, Troughton gives this amazing speech in the episode where he's like, you know, the universe has bred the darkest things. They must be fought. You know, it's this great speech. Mm-hmm. It's basically what we call in the Doctor Who world, base under siege, which means they're all in one place and it's constantly being attacked by the bad guys. So there's this virus that's spreading and make people sick. You know, I adore this story. I love the Cybermen. The slow, methodic, you know, they're coming for us. There's nothing we can do to stop it. And yet they're still slow and scary in their own way. And the trappings of the episode, you know, they're on the moon. It's all about weather control. Like, they can control the weather on the planet Earth. All these countries cooperating together. I mean, that's what the future is supposed to look like, right? We're supposed to be on the moon. We're supposed to all be getting along, things like that. So
it is a terrific production design, that set with the great big pendulum swingy thingy and the costume design, the space. It's incredibly futuristic. So, yeah, great looking show.
I absolutely adore it. So, and I love that streamlined look of the Cybermen in Moon Base as well. So that's my favorite Cybermen. What about you?
I'm going to go Earthshock because I think, you know, that was the design of Cybermen. They're a little bit more up to date. They certainly moved away from the sleeker look that they had in Troughton's era. And yeah, and I think Earthshock is just a terrific story. I think it's probably my favorite Cyberman story.
So we're talking like 1982. This is Peter Davison, yeah, the guy with the cricket outfit. And now they have all kinds of like vacuum hoses all over them and things like that.
Yeah. And Earthshock as well is just a terrific story. It's really well told. It's got a couple of really big twists. The first one is actually the involvement of the Cybermen at all, because that wasn't telegraphed in any way. And it has a real shock ending. Shall I spoil it 30 years on? No. If you want to go and watch Earthshock, you go and watch Earthshock and be staggered by how it ends.
I'm pretty sure everyone knows by this point, but that's fine.
But of the ones you mentioned, I love Tomb of the Cybermen. I love Invasion. Two of the best Pat Troughton Cybermen stories, in my opinion. And The Wheel in Space. Now, The Wheel in Space is another one of those lost episodes, but I have the audio soundtrack. So again, it's really vividly in my head. And let's not forget Big Finish. Terrific Cybermen stories on Big Finish, which is the audio dramas, Spare Parts, and then there's a trilogy, The Harvest, The Reaping, and The Gathering. And if you want some really good Cyberman stories, yeah, go and explore Big Finish, because they've got masses of good stuff on there.
Spare Parts is possibly one of the best Cyberman stories ever told, television, audio, a book, yes, anything. Spare Parts, yeah, is exceptional. It's so good.
Yeah, agree.
All right, so the next section is a whole smattering of stuff in here. This is just sort of the collection.
Weird and wonderful.
Right, exactly. So you've got the robot from The Giant Robot, Tom Baker's first episode, which is a lovely two-pager. Then you've got the servo robot, which is this, I don't even waste my time talking about it. Anyway, then you have the Quarks, the white robots. You've got the Mavellans you talked about earlier, the Mavellan sidearm. You've got the Skonos blaster. I mean, as a kid, you know, things like the servo robot, who is barely even in The Wheel in Space, right? Like, but it gets a two-page spread in here. This really overinflated the importance of these characters to me as a kid. I thought, well, the servo robot, yes, he's got to be a pretty darn big deal. You know, yeah, same thing with the white robots. These are a big deal. Not so
and
much.
And the Skonos blaster, just why? It's from the horns of Nymon, which is not a well-regarded story. The blaster is not a big part of the story. And it is the most generic looking ray gun you have ever seen. Why has it got two pages? I have no idea.
It's sort of like DC Comics publishes book called The Who's Who that I've spent, yeah, a lot of time covering on podcasts. And every once in a while, you'll get a giant page on a character that appeared like once, and it really overinflates the sense of that character's importance. Yeah. And it's absolutely, yeah, what's going on here. This is the Rex the Wonder Dog of Doctor Who. It's like, really? This is important? Okay.
Do not diss Rex the Wonder Dog.
Well,
okay.
I do love Rex the Wonder Dog, but Rex got as much of a page as Animal Man, so I thought he was just as, yeah, important. So
vital.
So rather than talking about the Skonos blaster, we're going to use this as a springboard to say, who or what was your favorite bad guy, alien race, or robot, or whatever, besides the Dalek and Cybermen? What do you got?
I'm going to go Zygons, which is Doctor Who does body snatchers. And I think it's such a grotesque costume, that sort of great big overhanging forehead. I think they've sort of slightly toned it down for the new series, but it's very creepy, very cool. And the organic controls for their spaceship was just really original and novel way of doing it. So yeah, I'm going to go Zygons, but I love the Jaggeroth, and we've got the Jaggeroth ship coming up, the Vok robots, Fendal, which do look a little bit obscene, and the Raston warrior robot is such a cool robot from the Fifth Doctor. Very sleek, jumps around, vanishes, and fires javelins and razor edge discs at you. Really cool. So lots of great monsters. What about you?
I would say the Raston warrior robot is a great concept, not realized so great, but that's okay. The Vok robots, though, and the Jaggeroth were, oh my gosh, so good. And the Zygons, I got to tell you, my absolute favorite appearance of the Zygons anywhere, and this is a weird one, was in some promotional art comic book art for Doctor Who drawn by Walt Simonson. Walt Simonson drew this image of a Zygon chasing Tom Baker. And it looks amazing. It looks so good. You're like, oh my God, I got to know what this monster is. So that's my favorite. As much as I love the Zygons, and I do, that's my favorite Zygon moment. Anyway, so my favorite bad guys besides Daleks and Cybermen are, and this is tough, but I brought it down. Well, I'll tell you my honorable mentions first. I strongly consider the Yeti and the Great Intelligence, particularly because I love those Target books. I read them over and over and over. By the way, Yeti and Cybermen, these go back to like the Second Doctor, black and white episodes, Patrick Troughton, and they were lost. Well, one of them still is, but lost for a long time. Now, they brought them back in the modern Who as well. Not the Yeti, but at least the Great Intelligence. Either way, I read those Target books over and over. And when the Web of Fear was found, which is all about the tube system in London, I was so thrilled. And it lived up to the reputation of my mind. I still love the Web of Fear. Yeah. It's so good. There's just something about those lumbering, I guess I like the slow Doctor Who monsters, maybe. The lumbering abominable snowmen, and they're just so creepy, and the idea of this freeform consciousness out there controlling them. Oh,
yeah. Growing up outside of London, I'd been in those tube stations, so I knew exactly what that felt like. Mm. Really good story. Terrific story. Yeah, and completely agree about the Target books as well.
Another honorable mention is the Ice Warriors. I just love the concepts behind them, and just the way they talk and things like that. But the choice I made, the ones I picked are the Silurians and the Sea Devils. I ridiculously love these characters. I love the idea that they were the first dominant life form on Earth before humans. You know, they're not aliens. So when they invade, it's not an alien invasion. They're just taking back what's theirs. You know, the classic stories in the Third Doctor, they were, and in the Fifth Doctor, there were such great locations. You know, the first one with the Silurians was these underground caves, very, you know, very claustrophobic and creepy. And then with the Sea Devils, you're all the way at the Stagmar Prison, which I love with the Master. And then with the Fifth Doctor, you've got this underwater base. They actually built a model of this underwater base. So visually cool. Great settings. I think visually they look awesome. They looked fantastic. They had this great voice that just sounded so threatening. Like, rah, 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 rah. I can't even replicate it. I won't even try. Never mind. But they just sounded fantastic. Now, I haven't been in love with the New Who reinterpretations, but yeah, I'm still glad they're using them. I think there's been some good done with them. But the Silurians and Sea Devils are absolutely my favorite.
Yeah, completely agree. And I'm so pleased you talking positively about Warriors of the Deep, which is not held in high regard generally, but I will defend to the hilt. It is the hill I will die on, is Warriors of the Deep. So everybody, even, you know, Doctor Who magazine publishes from time to time a sort of rank order of what people's favorite stories are. And I have to say, Warriors of the Deep does that, but everybody loves a different story. And that goes back to that diversity. And everybody will defend a different story. So even the ones that are not stone cold classics, it's a favorite for somebody. And that's great. I love that about the show.
And I have to admit, Warriors of the Deep, also one of my favorites. Oh, it's I'll say it's not good, but I don't care. It's a favorite. So.
We will take this discussion offline.
Yes, sir. Well, and in the interest of time, we're going to blaze through these next several entries for that reason. There is an entry on the Space Freighter, the most generic spaceship ever. There's the Earth Titan Shuttle, which, again, is really generic. Again, they don't even tell you what episode these are from. You had touched on at the beginning. Then you get the Jaggeroth ship, which is absolutely gorgeous, from City of Death, which is the Douglas Adams classic. And then you get the Doctor's hover car, right? The Doctor, which is really kind of a cool thing that John Pertwee would drive around in his final episode. It looked really, really great. But we're not going to use that one as a springboard.
The only thing I will say is the BBC on its budget reused the Titan Shuttle for something else that I know you and I are both fans of, and that's Blake 7. But that is definitely a discussion for another show.
Oh my gosh. Is this the shuttle that was from the first episode where he goes to the Cygnus Alpha colony?
Yeah.
I never knew. The moment you said it, I knew it. Oh, okay. All right, I got to stop. All right, I love Blake 7. We are doing an episode on Blake 7 at some point in the future. But, all right.
We are just 2/3 of the way through our 6-monthly rewatch of the whole thing.
Really? Oh, it's such a good show. All right, Chris, I got to tell you, you got me so wound up just now, but I can't take us down the Blake 7 direction because I will do another hour right now. So I got to stop us. Okay. All right. The final section of the book is Build a TARDIS, which is so cool. They actually gave you little schematics. You're supposed to go and Xerox copy these pages, and then you're supposed to cut with an X-Acto knife. You're supposed to cut them out, glue them down on cardboard, and you build your own little homemade TARDIS. Now, I never did it, but let me tell you, I stared at these pages for hours and imagined I was going to do it. So I was like, you know, I'm going to get my mom to photocopy these, you know, whatever. I always knew it was just going to happen someday soon. I never did. But I was just sure as a kid I was going to be doing this. So did you ever cut it out and build it yourself?
No, I don't think we had access to photocopier machines when I was 12. But yeah, no, and I would never, ever take a knife to a book so dear to my heart.
Right. That's why I said photocopies.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I don't know. Maybe I could do now. Sneak into work, photocopy it, card back it, do it now. There we go. Yeah. I could do that. A little hobby project.
You could go to the store and just buy a TARDIS now. Back then we couldn't, right?
So Yeah.
Now, where I'm going with this one for our discussion is there was not a lot of Doctor Who toys and merchandise growing up, at least for me here in the States. So did you ever make your own Doctor Who stuff? I'll let you go first and then I'll finish up for us.
Yeah, so we did. Like I say, we sort of made models. My late dad was an engineer and he was very practical and very crafty kind of guy. And so he made us a number of things. One thing we've just touched on, Blake 7, he made us Blake 7 teleporter bracelets.
Oh.
That's for another show. But he made out of plywood and electronics, he made us a K9 and it was fantastic. It had motorized wheels, it had ears that wiggled, it had a light up eye panel and laser nose. And my primary school fancy dress competition, I went as the Fourth Doctor with the K9. And true to form, it did not move well on grass. So It was great. But we did have more Doctor Who merchandise. And I'm going to come out and say I had Doctor Who underpants, a big old portrait of Tom Baker right on the front. And I'm not ashamed. In fact, I may have had more than one pair. So we maybe had a little more merchandise than you did. And obviously the books and the annuals and all the rest of it.
Wow, that is amazing. We didn't have access to any of that over here, man. Basically, there was a couple things in sci-fi stores, mostly books, again, like, you know, this technical manual, things like that. So some of the homemade stuff I had was Doctor Who over here. We had a fan club called the Doctor Who Fan Club of America. Uh-huh. And they published this giant newsletter. It was like a little small newspaper. It was a really high-end production. And in there, they printed Tom Baker's scarf pattern. So my great aunt knitted a 12-foot scarf for me from the Whovian Times. Because I remember she didn't know anything, the first thing about Doctor Who. And so she's asking me, she's like, are you sure you want it this long? Are you really? You know, like, and I'm like, yep, I really do. And so she made that, and I still have it. It's hanging on the wall. I've worn it to several Doctor Who events, things like that. I made my own, at one point, a quote-unquote working console, and this was the most jury-rigged thing ever, but it basically, I just used a small cardboard box. I mean, we're talking no more than like 12 inches by 12 inches. It wasn't big. And I cut a hole in the center, a round hole in the center, and I took the round cap from a spray can, like spray paint can, and I put that in the middle, and I taped string to it, and using a pulley system I rigged up myself, I taped it down to my record player. So my record player would go around and around, and as it did, it would pull this string taut, and then it would give the string slack, and then pull it taut and give it slack. And using the pulley system, this made the little console actually go up and down. And so that was my Doctor Who thing. I was so proud. I was so excited about that as a kid.
The world of engineering has had a great loss in you, Shag, hasn't it?
Sure. Yeah, we'll say that. That's fine. Temporal engineering. Then we actually had a local fan club when I'm in like sixth grade. It wasn't even a fan club. It was like five kids, right, from my middle school and some of the parents that liked the show as well. So it was less of a club and more like just friends who liked the same thing. But the parents actually produced like a little newsletter, a little fanzine with kids' input. I mean, we're talking very, very local. It's a couple of pages, you know, on a Xerox machine, on blue paper. It's got a couple of photos of some of the kids. Like short articles and some of the kids' artwork, which included a drawing I did of a Dalek, which I drew based upon the designs in this technical manual. So you see how it all comes full circle.
It all
there
comes around.
Exactly. It all comes Adric full circle. So all right, so we're gonna start to wrap up here. So I'm gonna ask you, Chris, in closing, what is your favorite thing about the technical manual?
I guess it's just the memories, but I guess that in terms of the entries, it's the TARDIS console, isn't it? Knowing what all those buttons do. I'm using air quotes around the word do. But, you know, looking at all the different things, the readout displays and the scanner controls and all those kind of things, fantastic. And it's just another exciting part of the fandom, isn't it? You know, and it was somebody thought to bring this together. So yeah, love it.
For me, it was the Wikipedia aspect of it. It was the fact that I had Doctor Who information that I had access at my fingertips, and I read it and read it and read it and read it. And if I had to pick a particular entry, believe it or not, I didn't touch on it earlier, it'd probably be the police box page, simply because it gives sort of an architectural drawing of what the TARDIS is supposed to look like. And I would draw that all the freaking time as a kid. And even would do like computer programs on Commodore 64.
Oh, yeah.
You know, trying to draw the TARDIS using character strings and stuff like that, and using this as my base model. Because I'm like, okay, I need this piece and this piece and this piece and this piece. So, yeah, I just absolutely adored this book so much and learned so much from it. Ugh. All right, now, Chris, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging around here in the time-space vortex for just a little while I read listener feedback from the previous episodes? Because I would feel better if someone was watching the transduction barriers to protect us from an invasion of like by the Daleks or Cybermen.
Okay, that's fine. I'll just make sure I've got lead panels everywhere. Floor, ceiling, everywhere.
Perfect. Make sure you got your toolkit with you, too.
Yeah.
So. But don't worry, Chris. We will bring you back at the end of the show. And after this podcast promo break, folks, I am going to read your listener feedback from the previous episodes.
Are you a fan of Doctor Who? How about comics? If you're a fan of both, then Doctor Who Panel to Panel is for you. This podcast looks in depth into the long history of Doctor Who comics, from the 1960s kid-friendly strips to today's present comics from Titan Comics and Doctor Who Magazine. I review stories old and new, featuring classic doctors like Tom Baker and Jon Pertwee, to the 12th Doctor himself, Peter Capaldi. I also interview the creators behind the stories, from authors such as Paul Cornell, to artists like John Ridgway and Lee Sullivan. I also talk to production people such as Titan Comics editor Andrew James, and Doctor Who Magazine editor Tom Spilsbury about their career and work on these great comics. Check out Doctor Who Panel to Panel on iTunes, Facebook, and download episodes direct from DoctorWhoComics.com.
And now, your feedback from the past few episodes of Once Upon a Geek. Now, some of you may recognize the music playing during this feedback segment. Yes, I did borrow it from my Justice League International podcast because I love it so much. All right, so got a request for you folks. So over on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, there is an opportunity where you can leave reviews for shows. Now, the Firewater Podcast Network itself has tons of iTunes reviews, but Once Upon a Geek is a very, very new show. So we could really use your help. If you wouldn't mind going out to Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whatever you want to call it, and leaving a review, it would really help raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. So I appreciate that. And as a thank you, I will read all iTunes reviews in their entirety during the next feedback segment of the show. All right. Now, as I promised, I am going to be reading your comments from our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. I have pulled all the feedback from the last four episodes. So the three episodes all about V and the episode about growing up geeky in the 1970s and 80s. And folks, I compiled all of the feedback from the website in a Google document, and it came out to 31 pages long. Oh my gosh. Wow. You folks are amazing. So here's what I'm going to do. I obviously can't read everything word for word. We'd be here for another four-hour marathon podcast, right? So instead, I'm going to be pulling just bits and pieces of your comments, trying to highlight some of the interesting bits there and read it out here in the show. But I believe if I did this right, I have name-checked every single person that left a comment on our website. Now, if I missed you for any reason, please just let me know. Drop me a line, and I will make good on that in the next feedback segment. All right. So first up, we're going to be talking about the Growing Up Geeky in the 1970s and 80s episode with my brother and sister. First comment comes from Martin Gray from the Two Dangers for Girl blog. Martin says, thank you for the first episode of Once Upon a Geek, and what a way to kick things off. Who needs the Shazam family when you have the Shag family? Eve and Lore are as cool as you, Shag. Aw, well, I appreciate that, Martin. Thank you. And he says, it was fascinating to hear Lore's story about being in the high school band. It still amazes me that U.S. high schools have these hierarchies where they're groups whose members have to date one another. I always thought that was made up for TVs and films. No, Martin, sadly, that is very, very real. Then he goes on to say, probably the TV show that made me a geek was the 1970s kids drama called Time Slip, which was about two British working class kids who discovered that they could travel in time via a time slip to the past and the future. The problem being that the mysterious phenomenon was invisible. It seemed to be set in the world outside my window, and I spent loads of time thereafter looking for the time slip, like I was a little tiny mime artist. The first episode had a bonus add-on of when it was transmitted, with the ITV news science correspondent explaining the theory behind it all. Who says TV can't be educational? Oh, that's awesome, Martin. Thank you so much for sharing. Then we heard from Dr. Chris Lewis. I have no idea who this guy is, and I wish he'd stop bothering me. Anyway, Chris writes, I definitely credit my father's love for sci-fi with my own interest in the genre. He would often get out books from the Golance Science Fiction Masterworks series from our local lending library. And I was reading those books of his that fueled my already growing interest in science fiction tales, especially ones with a core of proper science. And he says, it's a shame that geek, nerd, dweeb, and all the other terms that you mentioned from your Venn diagram have such negative connotations, even when superhero movies and TV shows completely rule the roost in terms of global entertainment franchises. Is this show an attempt to reclaim the term that's been used as an abuse? Well, you know, Chris, maybe, I guess, a little. Maybe in my own way, I am reclaiming the term geek. I'm not really sure. Then we heard from Tom Panarese, who hosts the show Pop Culture Affidavit and Required Reading and more. Tom says, about being a geek, it was really in the 5th and 6th grade where the whole concept seemed to rear its head. Up until then, I think my friends and I liked all the same stuff, you know, like Star Wars and Voltron and G.I. Joe and Transformers and Thundercats and Masters of the Universe and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and the WWF, and nobody got on anybody's case about it. Then, at some point, things separated, and I went from being just part of the herd to being called a geek suddenly because I liked Star Trek and read comic books. Then Tom goes on to say, I love the conversation with your brother and sister too. I like how geekdom can run in a family and thought it was really cool to hear your origins as far as your geekiness is concerned. I have a younger sister whose interests are a lot different than mine. She's a horse geek, but we do share a love of certain movies and both have real interest in genealogy, which has led us to a mutual love of Newfoundland culture and music. Wow, that's really cool, Tom. And he says, with my parents, we definitely have different tastes, although I can attribute my love of movies to my dad, who would take me and my friends to any and every shitty action movie that came out in the 1980s and early 1990s. He was also that guy at the video store who had rented just about everything. He also let me rent just about anything, which meant I saw Porky's at age 15. Seriously. You know, thanks to cable, Tom, you're not alone there. Then we heard from Jossum. I love your handle, man. Jossum, it's great. Jossum says, truly enjoyed listening to your family's tales, especially about your secret admirer comic. What a great big sister. While we don't share many of the same geekdoms, I will be listening to you and your co-host regaling in your joy. Aw, well, thank you, Jossum. I appreciate that. Then we heard from Dr. Robert Gross. He quotes me saying, everyone is geekier in their own way. From there, he says, I had to practice the piano a lot, and I didn't even have a favorite band or anything. I was playing classical music. It wasn't until well into high school that I found non-classical musicians that I became passionate about. But that's how I became a musician in my adult life. Everything changed when I was 15 years old and found other geeky musicians at music camp at a university. It was the first time I remember feeling normal. Oh, wow. I'm sorry you had to wait that long, Rob. Then we heard from Chuck Coletta, who's Dr. Pop Culture over on Twitter from the Bowling Green State University. Chuck says, I really enjoyed this walk down memory lane. I barely remember my high school days, so it's nice to hear folks whose recollections are so vivid. Huh, thank you, Chuck. Then we heard from Damian Drouet-Whiter, who hosts the Should I Love This Comic podcast. Damian says, your secret admirer comics introduction is such a sweet story. I wish I had as a defined an origin story, but I really just always read comics. My mom was a fanatical reader, and from a very early age, she encouraged both me and my sister to read. When I was very young, we were very poor, but still every day my mom got a newspaper, which we would then read the comic strips together. And every week we got a comic book because reading had to be pleasurable. I have so much to be grateful to my mom for, but for my love of reading is one of the key shared passions across our entire family. Ah, that's awesome, Damien. Then her from Matt Sorois says, my brother and I shared a lot of our geekery as well as having our own specific fanaticism. We currently do our own podcast reflecting on our favorite movies. Keep on geeking and finding your joy. Too few podcasts spread joy. Oh, well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. Then her from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary and the Legion of Super Bloggers. Dr. Ange says, I am the youngest of 5 kids, so I drew out a lot of my loves from my siblings. But my brothers were the more geeky in their ways, and they've influenced me a ton. We each have a niche or two, but the overlap is there. I'm just a couple years older than you, so the references and touch points are the same. So this was all so fascinating, and the stories were all so similar, and so many smiles as I listened. And then he goes on to say, I will say at my job, I've gone the other way and completely completely embrace the geekiness. The world knows I'm the comic book guy. I tape comic book panels on my office door. I put up comic stuff in lectures. I quote movies during the shift, and it's all been good. You know, Ange, that's awesome. I'm so glad you're able to be open like that in your workplace. That's so cool. Then heard from Ido Bosnar, who says, kudos to all three of the Irredeemable siblings. There's a few bits in particular that really struck a chord with me. First up was school bus seating. Yes, where I grew up in a pretty rural community in Oregon, the cool older kids sat in the back, while the front seats were where the first and second graders had to sit. Then, second, underoos. I specifically had a Superman and Batman set just so I could wear the tops like normal t-shirts. Ah, represent. I love that. Then regarding Star Wars at trading cards, he says, man, for about a year after the movie was released, a few school chums and I were crazy about these. We bring them to school and compare them and trade them with each other for the ones we didn't have to complete our collections. I had stacks of them. And then almost overnight, I lost interest. I think I donated my whole box full of them to the local church for a charity flea market a few years later. Well, hey, you know, at least it went to a good cause. Then we heard from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He's got the upcoming House of Frankenstein, and he does JLU cast and so much more. Chris says, great first episode, Shag. I appreciated the look into the Irredeemable family setting. My sister is 7 years older than me, so we had a similar relationship in many ways, it seems. I don't think she ever threatened to burn anything, but there's definitely some of the whole, you know, if you tell mom and dad, all type of moments. And he says, I've been lucky enough to feel comfortable in letting my geek flag fly at work. I wear a Superman watch every day, and I drink from a Star Trek mug at work, and I found it's more of a conversation starter for me, but your mileage can vary. Well, Chris, I think, again, like Ange, that's awesome that you can do that at your office, and I think that's so cool. Then we heard from Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast, as well as Dial F for Flanger and more. Paul says, it's lovely that you're all so close, and I'm a bit jealous. Very enjoyable episode. Glad you found your podcasting joy again in this way. Oh, thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. Then we heard from Lucien Desaro, says, it was great hearing everyone's geeky journey. It reminded me so much of how my brother influenced my geekdom, specifically one of my brothers that was 12 years older than me. He collected comic books, and when he left home, he gave them to me. I spent several summers reading comics from this giant cardboard box filled with comics. All of them were horror comics and a few Tarzan. A few years later, he gave me his stack of Advanced Dungeons and Dragons books. I read the Monster Manual so much. Then my other brother played Kiss on the record player when I was really young, like under age 4. And he had me listen to them with my headphones on. So as a kid, I liked the band because there were only a few makeup changes away from only a few makeup changes away from Bozo the Clown. That's awesome. Then we heard from T. Ross Atkin from Gallifrey's Most Wanted podcast. Ross says, my older brother gave me comics to keep me occupied, but all it did was make me want more. So over the 10 years, he introduced me to Marvel and DC and Star Trek and Doctor Who and much more. This led me to finding even more nerdy things to devour. Over the years, I have worked in and managed and own comic book shops. I still love all the nerdy things he taught me about and, like you, ended up podcasting. Keep up the amazing work. Aw, well, thank you so much, Ross. I appreciate that. Then we heard from Siskoid from the Firewater Podcast Network. He does shows such as Who's Editing, Gimme That Star Trek, and much more. Siskoid says, it's kind of surreal to hear Shag repeatedly say, quote, geek isn't a bad thing, especially on this network. Just goes to show how deeply he was wounded by bullies who did think that geek was a bad thing. This episode needs a psychology tag attached to it. thanks so much, Siskoid. Then Captain Entropy chimed in and says, thanks for sharing your family and your stories with the Shag. They were all wonderful. And as a bonus, they completely debunked Rob's speculative hypothesis regarding your true origin. For example, aliens left you behind, your lab experiment gone wrong, things like that. Thank you so much for that. Then we're from Noah Tarnow from the Big Quiz Thing. Noah says, Shag, your story about the Kiss posters takes me back to my first day of kindergarten. I was so excited to show off my new lunchbox featuring my favorite rock band, Kiss, despite not knowing a single one of their songs. It was such a prized possession. And when the teacher told us about the fire drills and warned us to leave all possessions behind, I thought, even my Kiss lunchbox? Gotta have priorities, right, Noah? Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald. Liz left lots of comments, but just to sort of narrow it down to some of the Doctor Who stuff to tie in with this episode, Liz says, I never hit any of my fans. I was watching PBS and saw my first episode of Doctor Who, the episode Robot, and I became a fan of this show ever since. I'd walk around with a tire gauge and pretend it was a sonic screwdriver. That's awesome. And the Fourth Doctor was really big time for me. I had a scarf, which I pretended was the Doctor's scarf. It was just blue and black, and it was just regular length, but still. I also had a cowboy hat that I pretended was his hat because I didn't own a fedora till later. Oh, that's fantastic, Liz. I also remember dressing up as the Doctor as a kid. Then we're from Gus Casals from the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and his Legion 60 Years Later podcast. Gus writes, great episode, Shag. Love hearing the dynamics of the Shag family and thinking about my own. We're in a very similar age, siblings included, but in different countries. Still, the whole older sibling with a taste for music, Kiss being part of that mix? Check. Sharing a love for certain TV shows as a family? Check. And I guess my biggest diversion was that I gave up on comics and fantasy sci-fi when I hit high school. Switched the geek major to music, only to come back by my college age. And boy, did I feel represented by the whole, quote, my show thing. Mine was Wonder Woman all the way. Ugh, great choice, Gus. Then we're from Mike Dinas. Mike says, I'm somewhat jealous of your stories, as I only have one older brother, and he's not a geek at all. And as much as I love him now, we certainly didn't get along as kids. So for me, I grew up feeling like I was the only one who enjoyed geeky, nerdy, dorky pursuits. While I had a few friends throughout school, none of them were on the scale of a nerd that I felt I was. While my parents and grandparents didn't mind my comic reading, they certainly felt like it was a lower form of reading and tried to graduate me to real reading of novels. And now, even though I work somewhat in a nerdy industry, my coworkers all have their own thing and none of them seem to be into comics like I am. Hence why I love this podcast network. Its creators and its incredible community. I finally feel like I've met people I can talk to about comics and not feel embarrassed or ashamed. You are awesome. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. Then we're from Nathan Archer, a good buddy of mine, also renowned cartoonist and creator of the Ella comic strip. Nathan says, it was great hearing from your siblings about their geeky experiences growing up. So much of what all three of you talked about also resonated hard with me, especially since I was the youngest sibling with only two of us, though. Like you, I was the comics nerd in the house, and my brother was the Star Wars geek, like Laura was. I have very fond memories of our parents introducing us to comics by taking us to Dave's Comics in Richmond, Virginia. It was there where I picked up my very first comic, the Who's Who issue with Cyborg on the cover, and I was hooked. My brother picked up the first issue of the Captain Carrot and Oz Wonderland War, so we both have great memories associated with those characters too. Over time, he dropped out of comics, but I kept going. And as we became older, he dipped his toes back in with Green Lantern Rebirth, and the two of us made regular Wednesday trips to the comic shop together throughout the entire Sinestro Corps and Blackest Night period. Even at the time, I thought that period of DC Comics was firing on all cylinders. I mean, come on, they were giving away Green Lantern rings every week! And it was so much fun to experience all of that in real time with family. Aw, Nathan, that's awesome that you and your brother got to do that together. And like you, Shag, I worked a couple of summers at a local comic book shop, the Time Capsule in Chester, Virginia, when I turned 13. Looking back, it was a relatively short experience, but one I'll always cherish. I was there at Ground Zero for Superman number 75, which felt like the only day in history that it was cool to work at a comic shop. Nathan, I can verify, yes, it was cool to work in a comic shop on that date. Then we heard from Doug Adamson, who says, it was a joyous celebration of family connection and geekery. I moved around a bit as a child due to my father's job, and I never really fitted in well with the other kids at my school. I did play a lot with the neighbors, though, when we pretended to be in Action Force, which is the UK version of G.I. Joe, and Star Wars and such. It was strange to play with kids who you didn't go to school with the sort of things that you would never play with your schoolmates. Perhaps because it was the whole anti-geek nature of school culture. Yeah, Doug, it might just be. Then we're from Jeff Owens. It says, Shag, I thoroughly enjoyed the episode. Looking forward to more. And Sean Corey says, great first episode, Shag. Can't wait to hear more. Ah, well, you know what, folks? Thank you so much for all the kind words about that first episode. That first episode with my brother and sister was really important to me. It meant a lot to me to get that recorded. And the fact that you guys really, really responded so positively meant a lot to me. And I'm planning another episode about growing up geeky right now that I'm hoping to produce in the next couple months. It's got kind of a different spin to it, but I hope you guys will enjoy it. All right, now we're going to get into your feedback on V. You know, those 4-hour marathon episodes. Oh my gosh. You know, we covered the original miniseries, the final battle, the TV series, the books, comics, all that kind of stuff. So I pulled all of that feedback together and we're going to go through it, hopefully, rapid fire here. And we're going to start off with some of the guests that appeared on the show. So first off is Dr. Robert Gross. He did the segment on music. He says, Andy's observation that the V original miniseries still holds up after all these years reminds me of something Kenneth Johnson said. He said that the acting was so on point that before they took the movie to special effects, he realized that it was going to take people's head off, or something to that effect, and knock people out because the story and the acting were that good. I think that's why it holds up and survives its otherwise somewhat dated special effects. I also had to watch V past my bedtime, so I watched it unbeknownst to my parents, alone and on a black and white television. Let me say, V is terrifying in black and white. And I think that if my parents had just made an exception and let me watch it with them, it might not have scared me so badly. Parenting fail. Oh, Robert, I'm so sorry. And then he goes on to say the shuttlecraft chase in the original miniseries, it goes on for 10 minutes. And we talked about that quite a bit in the episode. He says, it is completely carried by the, wait for it, the music, of course. That scene would not have worked at all without Joe Harnell's masterful score propelling it along. You know, Robert, you're the expert on music. I'm not going to argue with you. Then as far as the final battle, Rob says, it was a disappointment to me as an advocate for disabled people that they didn't let Ham Tyler be in a wheelchair and being a disabled badass. That would have been in many ways a much more powerful depiction of this character. Then he says, I always thought it was pretty nice of the visitors to cure cancer. You know, when you think about it, what self-respecting lizard person would want to eat a human riddled with cancer? Clever, those visitors. Yeah, that was totally caring for your livestock kind of thing, I think, Rob. Then he says, I think Donovan on the horse underscores the degree to which the humans had to rely on asymmetric low-tech warfare to defeat the visitors. You know, the visitors had shuttlecrafts, we had horses, but a lot of wars are actually fought like that. Then he says, Fagrant's performance in the conversion chamber is stunning. Too bad that sci-fi never wins Emmys or Oscars, because she should have won an Emmy. Unless the Emmy goes to Jane Badler, who is also exceptional throughout. Next, we heard from Andy Leyland. He was our guest when we talked about V, the original miniseries. Andy has his own podcast, such as Palace of Glittering Delights, Hey Kids Comics, and more. Andy says, the music score stuff is fascinating. As a kid, I preferred the score to the final battle, and as an adult, I have to wonder, what was I smoking? Then he goes on about V, the weekly TV series. He says, kudos to you and Jared for being relentlessly positive in the wake of V, the series, a truly awful show that doesn't even deserve the description of tripe. Badler and Chadwick were a high point for a 13-year-old me. Can't imagine why. But I honestly thought the show reeked of desperation and opportunism. I was going to say why, but Bob Greenberger covered it. The producers. There was an interview in Starlog with them in which they said, quote, we already have the sci-fi crowd. We need to attract the regular audience, end quote. What an arrogant and baseless statement. They didn't have us just because they have lizards and lasers, because we know when something is terrible. V had a mainstream audience, and you guys squandered it with your unimaginative crossover of the A-Team and Dallas. All good points, Andy. All good points. Then we heard from Diabolu Frank, who was on the first episode of V as well, who helped us cover the promotions and the hype. Frank has his own podcast network called the Rolled Spine Podcast Network, where he has a number of shows, including his Dark Horse Presents show, which is all about the Aliens franchise. So Frank says, I definitely still prefer the title music for the final battle, a lifelong instrumental earworm to match the Untouchables. Well, Frank, you're being controversial as always. Then as far as the final battle goes, he says, what strikes me as the most offensive thing about the sequel is about how boyish it is. The first miniseries is a true speculative fiction, using the metaphor of the Holocaust in the arc of colonialism to paint a grim picture of how the interest of alien visitors would negatively impact society. You have multiple generations of Jewish characters whose past and present experiences play out in a human drama buoyed for the masses by science fiction elements. Then that narrative itself undergoes a hostile colonization as the Hebrews are replaced by a Catholic priest, communal discussions about whether a specific young woman should be forced to come to term for the greater good, and a nauseating excess of God out of a box to dictate and resolve the story. Wow, Frank, not pulling any punches. Regarding the toys, he says, I think I saw the Visitor laser pistols on sale briefly as a kid, but I bought the 45er instead. Besides identifying more with the Resistance, it's the only toy pistol I ever encountered with a working slide and recoil. Extremely realistic by the standards of the day, and so I enjoyed loading like an action movie star almost as much as firing it. The mechanism wore out fairly quickly, though, leaving it a silent and inanimate hunk of plastic. Aw, I'm sorry, I bet little Frank was sad. Then Frank, as usual, takes me to task. He says, it's awful swell that you committed so many people and so much effort to celebrate the, 39th anniversary of V. Or as it's historically known, quote, unlike many other anniversaries, the 39th anniversary doesn't have a traditional gemstone or gift, end quote. All right, Frank, I get it. Yes, I could have waited for the 40th anniversary of V to celebrate it, but yes, I covered it this year. So let's see, if the 40th anniversary is the Ruby Red anniversary, I guess that means the 39th anniversary is the Red Dust anniversary. So there you go. We all win. Then my buddy Keechy Baker took me to task on the length of the episodes. Thanks for that, Keith. Then we heard from Pete. It just goes by Pete, so I don't have any other name to go with it. So hey, how you doing, Pete? So Pete says, I was 10 when this aired in the UK and was instantly captured. Julie being shot in the scene with Ben and Elias is amazing. Plus also the opening dream sequence in episode 4 with Mike and Sean being gunned down in slow-mo, so good. Wow, well, thank you, Pete. Then we're from Leslie Trigg, who says, I love the discussion about the show's music. I don't have the musical intelligence to pick up on those details, but thanks for highlighting them. This is a quick question. Where can I find the soundtracks to V and V the Final Battle? Well, Leslie, you know, that's a good question. Unfortunately, you would think they'd be available in the digital age, but they're really not. So the only place I have been able to find them legally is if you order the soundtracks, the physical CDs, old used physical CDs. I'd recommend trying eBay and Amazon. I have seen them there for very reasonable prices. Then we heard from Alan W. Wright from the Robin Hood website, boldoutlaw.com. Also does the Blake 7 podcast, Straight Out of the Federation, and more. Alan writes, I came to V via the weekly series, so I had a few advantages from seeing the original original miniseries a few years later. I caught far more of the politics than I would have in 1983, but also I had seen the two films released later, The Killing Fields and Salvador. Those films were based on real-life journalists Sidney Shanberg and Richard Boyle, and I feel like they were the real-life inspirations for Mike Donovan. You know, Alan, you could be right. As Kenneth Johnson said, a lot of these characters were based on real people, so those could be the people Donovan was based on. Alan goes on to say, I first thought that Donovan was the hero, the leader, but that was from watching the weekly series. In the original miniseries, Julie is truly the leader and the hero. Yeah, it's a little disappointing how they kind of had Julie take a backseat. You heard from Chris Franklin again. He says, your discussion did stir up more memories. I specifically recall my mom letting me stay up past 11 o'clock on a school night to watch the entire episodes. So I saw the lizard reveal in real time. Such parental gestures were usually only reserved for the ABC Sunday night movie when they were airing Superman or a James Bond film. Wow, that is a special privilege. Then about the final battle, Chris goes on to say, the Star Child bit didn't make any sense to me as a kid, and I'm sort of sorry to hear that there's no better explanation for it now. Yeah, it's completely nonsensical, and no one gets it. Chris says about the merchandise, yes, I would have loved to have that 12-inch visitor figure, but I don't recall ever seeing it in the wild. He says, great packaging on horrible toys is a common theme for foreign and often unlicensed merchandise, but I think these V products kind of take the cake. I've seen some domestic PVC-type figures with equally horrible paint jobs, so I wasn't as shocked by the V figures as Shag, and hearing Derek cracking up over the quote-unquote space missile was worth the price of admission. Let's see. Then he says, in the past few years, I have somehow found myself collecting more and more vintage lunchboxes. If I ever come across that V lunchbox, I'm giving you a call, Shag. Ooh, that would be wonderful, Chris. Thank you so much. Then Chris references V, the original miniseries. He says, I have to mention that Abraham was played by Leonard Camino, who, to a certain age of group of nerds, is to be forever known as the scary German guy in the Monster Squad. The beauty of his casting is that he's not scary at all, and he befriends and helps the Monster Squad. But the best scene in the movie is when they tell him, quote, you sure know a lot about monsters? And he responds, I suppose I do. And we see the concentration camp tattoo on his arm. Now, this was a few years after V, and that's all we got as far as relevance, but it still resonates. Yeah, I mean, that's such a powerful, powerful moment. Then Tom Panarese follows up and says, I just looked up Leonard Camino's IMDb page, and under the trivia, it notes that while he was not a Holocaust survivor, despite being known for playing two in the 1980s, he did enlist in the army in 1940 and took place in D-Day. Oh my gosh! Abraham was a badass! That's amazing. Tom goes on to say the music discussion was incredibly fascinating and a real treat. And then Tom has started to watch V along with us. He says, I started watching the original miniseries while walking today, so I watched the first 45 minutes and was struck by how many of the actors I recognized. And then he goes on to say, I'm not even to the big visitor reveal yet, and it's gripping drama. I'm impressed by how long they were able to let this story build and also really develop the various characters. Then moving on to Final Battle, he says, to your point in the episode about the music, I can see why the scoring in this just doesn't match up, especially with the last 30 minutes or so. I love the opening theme to V the Final Battle because of the Terminator John Carpenter feel, but what is it with the saxophone between Mike and Julie and the weird 70s-ness of the balloon sequence and the very end? I was half expecting The Fifth Dimension to sing Up, Up, and Away in My Balloon during the balloon red dust moments, and at the very end we're suddenly cribbing The Love Boat or something? And then he goes on to say about the books, great talk with Scott Rifen about the books. I've got several and they are waiting to be read. Yeah, you better get on that, Tom. Time to start reading. And then when we got to the episode about the TV series, he had caught up quite a bit and he says, I still haven't watched every episode of the ongoing TV show, although I did recently get the DVD set off of eBay. This is all your fault, by the way. Well, you know, Tom, I just like to consider myself an economic stimulator, so... And then about the comics, he says, I have been collecting the comics where I can find it, and I just have to track down the last four or five issues. And finally, he says, I love the segment on the merchandise, by the way. You two were like little kids with all that energy, and it was just so great. And I was like you with the puffy stickers. I put them wherever I could or was allowed, and eventually they'd wind up peeling apart so that all that remained was the white backing, which was a silhouette in the shape of He-Man or whoever was on the sticker. Tom, I can't tell you how much that brought back memories. I had completely forgotten. You're absolutely right. With the puffy sticker, when it peeled off, and invariably it would, you're right. You were just left with that like little white silhouette of whatever it was. That is hysterical. Thank you so much. I heard from Matt Soroyce again. He goes, this is some really in-depth coverage. I didn't catch the original miniseries until it was rebroadcast ahead of V the Final Battle, so I got to experience it as a huge five-part event. It was truly epic. Most recently, I tracked down a copy of V the Second Generation, the book by Kenneth Johnson, which ignores the events of the Final Battle and gives us an idea how Johnson would have followed up on the original story. Yeah, you know, I own the second generation. I read it once. I didn't give it a fair shake. And, you know, I really do need it. It's in the garage, I think. I really need to dig that out and give it another try, Matt. So then he says, I will never forgive V the series for existing. I have mixed feelings as it was approaching. I absolutely loved V in the final battle. I did indeed want more, but the final battle wrapped up things. How would they do more? I tuned in and watched the show, and I felt like I was slapped in the face. They killed Martin? Why? He was a great character. Then the show meandered along, killing off more characters and writing off others. I gave up on the show. Now, when the Sci-Fi Channel re-aired the show, I gave it a second chance, much to my regret. A cliffhanger ending? Why do you have to ruin everything? If you were canceling the show, why not cut out the whole bomb part? The show could have ended with the possibility of peace. Then you drag your feet on giving us a resolution? I hate this series and completely disavow it. Now, to be totally hypocritical, I love the DC comic. Those covers were awesome. Personally, I think they told a better story than the show. Otherwise, they weren't limited by the budget the way the show was. It only makes me hate the show even more, knowing that DC was prepared to wrap up the show's story, but the showmakers blew that too. So what I think you saw there, folks, was Matt Soroy sort of working through some childhood trauma, I think is what that was. Then we're from Brian Litton. It says, I don't know if I saw the original series when it premiered, but I do remember watching it when we visited family later that summer. They had taped both episodes, so I spent most of the trip repeatedly watching V and running around with the backyard with my brothers and cousins, pretending to be resistance fighters. I was too young at the time to catch all the socio-political commentary and definitely need to go back and watch the series again. Then we're from Matt Evans, who says, I absolutely adored V when it first screened in the UK, and it was good to get a little more context from Andy on the weird circumstances surrounding how that happened. It's fair to say that age 10, my primary concerns with the pew-pew and the lizards and the spaceships and the evil alien rodent lady who gave me strange and confusing feelings. I've not seen it since then, so you're now tempting me to revisit with a view towards the political, allegorical side of things. One final note on the lasting cultural impact of V, at least over here in the UK, the animated GIF of Robin's lizard baby being born seems to do the rounds whenever a new royal baby arrives, before whom we are expected to prostrate ourselves, and rightly so. That's awesome. Then from my buddy Ken Deemer, it says, great stuff. I remember the original miniseries, TV shows, and the comics. Had such high hopes for the new show, I might have been too hopeful. Love the comments and the discussion. Well, thank you, Ken. Then heard from Kira when it's a great episode. I had to listen to it in bites, but it's absolutely worth it. As for the Space Invaders thing, what I think Frank may have been referring to was in 2007, Aqua Teen Hunger Force Mooninite incident in Boston, where the LED placards of Mooninites, which look a lot like Space Invaders, mysteriously appeared and spawned a bomb scare that was all over the news. Wow, that is crazy. Then heard from Siskoid again, it says, Shag never goes in with half measures. Great stuff, all the segments, and as to the length, I treated it like three weekly episodes I was simply catching up on. Then he says, I had a joke prepared about how lazy you were not to cover the revival, but I can't bring myself to say it with a straight face. Then we heard from Mike Dynas, who says, fantastic job, everyone. Shag, your enthusiasm for V oozed through the speakers and made me excited for this 40-year-old show. All the guests and the interstitials were very enjoyable, and like the others mentioned above, I loved the music talk with Dr. Gross. Since I know a little bit about music, it was amazing to hear how in-depth the V composer went when composing his themes. So good. Then Mike goes on to say, though I haven't read any V novels, I'm all on board with novelizations of shows and movies and then continuing adventure tie-in novels. I have a bunch of Star Wars and X-Files and Indiana Jones novels. The V novels sound like a lot of fun, and there's something satisfying about being able to knock out a book in a day. Oh yeah, absolutely, Mike. Then Mike says, while all your guests are a joy to listen to, I really enjoyed the interview with Bob Greenberger. I love listening to all those insider stories about comics business back in the 1980s, and this interview was no different. I also like Devin's story about being 10 years old and pitching the book to the publisher. But that's the great thing about fandom. It stirs something in all of us that we want to contribute to our favorite things. With the resurgence of V merchandise in Argentina, has Devin thought about pitching any news stories? Then we heard from Paul Keehan from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, who does the Batman Family Reunion podcast. Paul says, great show, Shag. Wow, what a Herculean effort. Now I have to go back and watch it. It's been 39 years after all. You can tell the whole episode was a labor of love, or should I say, a labor of joy. Thank you, Paul. Then we heard from a very dear old friend, Ed Crosby, who's with Learn Linux Now. Ed says, fantastic job. As everyone else has mentioned, I was totally intrigued in the music topic. It's not to say the other topics were any less enjoyable. They were really fun to listen to also. As many times as I've seen this series, this episode motivated me to go back and watch it again. I think I'm up to my 20th-something viewing now. Despite the fact that a lot of the series hasn't really aged that well, especially the final battle, even though I can never get enough of Michael Ironside, it's still great fun to watch over and over. Yeah, you know, Ed, Ed, I'm pretty sure you and I watched my old VHS copies back in the late 80s, probably repeatedly, on our VCR at home. I'm pretty sure you did. Then we heard from Martin Gray again about the V, the original miniseries coverage. He goes, how wonderful that your first guest is a Brit. I don't remember where I was when V first arrived on UK telly, other than sitting in front of the TV, not watching the Olympics. I do remember finding it terribly absorbing, and pretty much all the characters were watchable. Well, except for Willie. He was annoying. Oh, and that Daft Robin. Oh my gosh, Martin, I wish I had that term Daft Robin when I was doing all that coverage. I think that would have been her nickname. Then he goes on to say, Robert Gross's insights into the soundtrack were absolutely fascinating. I'm someone who enjoys music, but doesn't really understand the technical aspects. I found Robert's setting out of the thinking behind the music and how it was working with the action was wonderful. Then about V, the Final Battle, he chimes in and says, Hamilton, huh? I always assumed that the name Ham was a biblical nod, but Hamilton makes more sense. I'd never heard that as a forename back then. You know, in full disclosure, when my guest said Hamilton for Ham on the air, that's the first time I had ever considered that Ham's full name was Hamilton. Blew my mind. So yeah, I was right there with you. All right, then heard from Rob Kelly from the Firewater Podcast Network. He does shows such as Pod, Dylan, Fade Out, and more. In reference to the V, the Final Battle coverage with Michael Bailey, he quotes Michael Bailey and says, I should not have been as invested in the Lizard Baby as I was, end quote. And then Rob says, that is possibly the greatest pull quote this network will ever produce. You might be right, Rob. You might be right. Then we heard from Lucien Desar, who said, every kid in the playground discussed the Lizard Baby. Having to be continued as the Lizard Baby stares into the camera was pure television magic. Oh, absolutely. Then he goes on to say, a balloon attack would be really slow. Reminds me of Austin Powers getting run over by a steamroller. Oh my gosh, Lucien. That is like a deep cut 90s reference that I totally am there for. I love it. So thank you so much. They heard from Jack Bond, who says, cool find on the Argentina V-Fighter. I get the feeling that this ship has flown in many fleets. As a quick search shows, someone has found it later sold on a card for Alf. Oh my gosh. With the wing markings being cartoony portraits of Alf himself. That is amazing. I want both of those now. Then we heard from David Young, who says, I was not only big into V, the two miniseries and the hour-long regular series at the time when they came out, I also got all the comic books and novels. I was 11 years old in 1983 when the first V miniseries aired. As a big buyer of comics at the time, buying and reading the entire DC Comics V run was an obvious no-brainer for me. I was also a regular buyer of Star Trek and Star Wars and any Marvel or DC superhero tie-in novels that I could find, plus the occasional TV novelization with Knight Rider or Street Hawk. Awesome. So when I saw the V novels, it was another no-brainer. Of course I bought them all. However, as your guest said, I likewise tended to buy more books than I actually got around to reading, more collecting them with the intention to eventually read them. Yeah, David, I totally get that. I don't even want to talk about how many books are in my bookcase waiting to be read. Then David goes on to say, I did finally start reading through the V novels from 2006 to 2010 and managed to read 11 out of the 16 over the course of those 4 years, before, as usual, putting them aside to get into something else. And then at the end he goes, I was very upset when the hour-long TV series was canceled. It didn't matter to me that it had lost a good bit of its quality by that time. I was nonetheless emotionally invested in Mike Donovan, Juliet Parrish, and the others. The series ending on a cliffhanger and the comic book ending soon after was my first real experience with something I really like suddenly ending. And that feeling is something I can still remember to this very day. You know, that's a great point, David, because, I mean, it did end very suddenly, and people were left just hanging. And that was a tough feeling back then. And, you know, using more recent analogy for myself personally, I'm a big, big, big fan of Stargate Universe. I know not a lot of people loved it, but I did. Like, I legitimately think it was great science fiction television. And when it just ended after two seasons, it crushed me. It's still to this day, I get angry that it just gone and that it vanished and it's never coming back. And it drives me nuts. So, yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. It can be a painful experience as a fan. Then we heard from Mike Kramer, who says, interesting note about the visitors' voices. In the final battle, Ham Tyler introduces a device to the Resistance that allows them to mimic the reverberated voices of the visitors. Of course, that is eventually dropped because the visitors' voices don't reverberate later. But flash forward 30 years or so, and the TV show Flash starts airing on the CW. One of the tricks that Grant Gustin's Barry Allen uses is to protect his identity from his friends is to hypermodulate his voice, which sounds exactly like a visitor's voice in V. In the second season, however, Barry had to give up his powers in order to secure the release of Wally West. Well, Wally wanted to thank the Flash for giving up his speed to save his life. During the meeting, Flash still spoke with a reverberated voice. After the meeting's over, Barry is seen removing the same device from around his throat that Ham Tyler used to mimic the visitors' voices. Oh my gosh, that is amazing, which also sparked a large conversation in the comment thread about people making up theories about Vibe, seeing alternate dimensions, and how V and Flash exist in the same universe, all kinds of fun stuff. There from Captain Entropy says, I wanted to weigh in on the long episodes. For whatever it's worth, I don't mind at all. If an episode is 4 hours long, it might take me a few days commuting to finish it, but that's fine. I wasn't going to cure cancer while I sat in traffic anyway. Well, thank you, Captain Entropy. I appreciate the support. Then we heard from Tamara Quist. She's been very supportive over on Instagram. She says, just a few comments here with the pair who played my favorite heroes. Faye Grant didn't want to be a part of the TV series and tried to get out of her contract early on. I'm amazed at how Faye still poured herself into the Julie role, even though she didn't want to be part of the show. By the way, I was rolling on the floor laughing at your assessment of Mark Singer's wardrobe in the series. There's an awesome convention panel video on YouTube where a female asks Mark about his tight jeans, and his response is hilarious. We talked about Michael Ironside leaving the series, and potentially there was some friction there. Tamara does say that on another convention panel on YouTube, Mark Singer does talk about how him and Michael Ironside were having differences and not getting along. So it does sound like there's a little bit something there. Then we're from David Ace Gutierrez, who says, you and your co-host brought back a lot of memories. Thanks for that. The original miniseries was the talk of the playground. We even played V as kids. I got stuck being Robert Englund's character, Willie. Now I'm in therapy. I'm so sorry, David. Then Devin Clancy chimed in. Now, if you remember, Devin was our co-host on the comic book segment, and he mentioned that as a kid, he had a Halloween costume dressed like a visitor that his mother designed. Well, he posted some of those pictures over on Facebook, and there's a link in the comment thread. You should check that out. They look fantastic. Awesome pictures. Great costume. Devin, your mother is to be commended. And then finally, a last comment from Adam Ackerman, who goes by Centaurin. His comment was actually about Doctor Who. Instead, he says, you say the next topic is Doctor Who. Who is this Doctor Who you speak of? Is it a weird trivia show where you try to guess who the famous doctor was? Well, Adam, with the nickname of Centaurin, I'm pretty sure you have a pretty good idea who Doctor Who is, and I hope this episode did justice to what you're expecting. So, all right, folks, woof, wow, that was a lot of feedback. My thanks to all of you for your support of the Once Upon a Geek podcast. You folks are absolutely amazing. Now, if you'd like to be included in the next feedback section, all you need to do is leave a comment on our website for one of the next few episodes. Again, that's fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. And then we will cover feedback again in another 5 episodes from now. So please keep all those cards and letters coming, folks. My thanks again to all of my co-hosts over the past few episodes. They were simply wonderful. And you listeners, thank you so much for an amazing collection of feedback. I really sincerely appreciate it, and I love how this is somewhat of a community where we're all sharing our thoughts about the topic. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see if we can bring Chris back from the time and space vortex.
Mother, I feel sick. Send for the doctor. Quick.
Hey gang, it's Mark from the Social Distance Warrior Podcast. With everything that's going on right now, don't you wish you could just get away from it all? Like, far away?
It's the year 5,023,000,000,023. We're in the galaxy M87.
Yeah, I think that's far enough. Well, then tune into the Straight Outta Gallifrey Podcast on the Ride On Network. It's just what the doctor ordered.
Well, I suggest before we go outside and explore, let us clean ourselves out.
See, he gets it. Am I he? I mean you. You know what I mean.
I am he, and he is me.
We are all together, Gugukichu?
Exactly. On Straight Outta Gallifrey, they'll cover every iteration of that Time Lord.
You may be a Doctor, but I'm the Doctor.
In addition to every other Time Lord in the Doctor Who universe. So tune in and escape into the world of Doctor Who.
The human race moves on, but so do the viruses. It's an ongoing war.
A little more upbeat, please.
Leaving is good. Never coming back is better.
That's more like it. Check out Straight Outta Gallifrey on RyonNetwork.com and follow us on Twitter at SoGallifrey.
All All right, folks, we're back from break. And yes, I have rescued Chris from the time-space vortex. Chris, thank you so much for appearing here on this episode of the show and sharing your love for Doctor Who. Thank you.
Thanks, Shag. It's been a real pleasure and a real honor because I know there's so many contributors who love Doctor Who. So to be asked on as your first guest to introduce the show to people who might not know it so much is a real honor. And I'm sure you'll come back to this show. And I'm really looking forward to hearing other people's contributions and other people's memories and reflections on it. And yeah, if you need me to come back, I'm always happy to talk about the Doctor or Blake Seven.
When I'm ready to have my All Merca All the Time episode, I'll give you a call. There's a deep cut for some folks. Now, Chris, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you on the internets?
Well, I'm doing quite a lot of recording for you guys. So I've just literally done a Film and Water with Rob, and we have another JLE thing in the future, and I'm really excited about that. And Rob and I have already done a Mashcast, but that's not coming out until the future. I don't know, you guys record recording and release schedules is just wibbly wobbly timey wimey. So somewhere on here, occasionally, I don't know, but yeah, really, really happy to record with you, Shag. It's great.
Well, thank you again so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And folks, come back next time when we are going to cover another topic that brings us joy. Now, what will that topic be? Sorry, folks, I'm not going to tell you this time. You're just going to have to find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Chris.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive.
Find your joy.